From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with journalist and author Liz Carpenter. In the 1960s, she served as press secretary to Lady Bird Johnson. She went on to campaign for women's rights and the ERA. Also today, I talk with Luis and Daniel Valdez. The Valdez brothers collaborated on the new movie La Bamba, the story of rock and roll singer Ritchie Valens. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording by pianist Shura Tchaikovsky. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg looks at the movement to make English the official language of America. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Liz Carpenter. In the 1960s, she was press secretary to First Lady Lady Bird Johnson. Before that, Liz Carpenter was executive assistant to Lyndon Johnson when he was vice president. She was one of the first women to hold such a post. It was Carpenter who wrote the 58-word text that Johnson read the evening President Kennedy was assassinated. When she worked for Mrs. Johnson, Carpenter saw her role as finding a way to help her help him. Liz Carpenter came to Washington from Texas in 1945 as a 21-year-old, $25-a-week reporter for a Washington news service. She worked for the Washington Bureau of several Texas newspapers before starting the Carpenter News Service with her husband. After her husband's death in 1974, Carpenter moved back to Texas. She later became active in women's rights issues. She was one of the founders of the National Women's Political Caucus and has lobbied actively for passage of the ERA. Liz Carpenter has written a memoir, a book she says started when she was 65, her Medicare birthday. The book is titled Getting Better All the Time, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
You say at the beginning of your book that a death of someone you love can shelve you. That didn't really happen to you, at least not for long. I know you went through a terrible period of grief, but what helped you get back on your feet?
Well, I think the words of a woman who came up to me, and I had that drained look that so many widows have for a while after the wrestling with all the gamut of emotions that you go through as you lose someone. And she took my hands and she said, "You've got to start thinking of it as a chance at a second life." And those words really jarred me, and I began to see it in different eyes. I think that also reading some things about what other women had done to recover was helpful. And one of the things was, strangely enough, to entertain, to fill your house with people. And there was a time when my home seemed most empty, and that was every weekend, because that was the time my husband and I had shared. And so I started forcing myself to plan a Sunday night supper for friends and to make myself use the good china and go get the pretty flowers and make it special. And that kept me occupied psychologically and mentally and physically, going and marketing. And it really was therapeutic. And somebody was going to be coming into the house Sunday night.
You know what, I think one of the tricks might be too to not allow people to feel sorry for you, because I think when someone loses a spouse, there's people, you feel so bad for the person that you maybe almost don't even want to see them because you can't bear the thought of so much pain.
Friends do avoid you, but I think you have to put on a happy face, so to speak, and not expose yourself to people who are congenital complainers, to not just make your friends a ring of widows, because you'll find that everybody's going to spend a little bit of time talking about the person they were married to, and that's no good. Naturally, you know, our age group, we know lots of widows. I know lots of widows, but I don't want to be isolated to one category.
You were lucky enough to have had a political life and a life as a journalist beforehand, and you had causes to throw yourself into after
your husband's death. And they were a big salvation, because it takes you outside yourself. You get your mind off yourself. And whether it's sick kittens or saving a restored part of the city, anything, and whether it takes a little bit of money to join something, you really need to do that.
You
get into something that isn't just inside you.
you really, I think, stepped up your activism in the women's rights movement. You had already been very active in it before your husband's death. But you know what I'm wondering about your activism in feminism? Some successful women of your generation didn't become actively involved in the women's movement, and they felt, well, I made it. What's the problem? I mean, I made it. Why can't other women do it? But you obviously didn't feel that way.
Oh, I think that that's a very selfish way to look at it. It seems to me the whole effort should be networking. And it seemed to me that one of the things that I could do was to cast my bread back on the waters for doors that might have opened for me. But I'd always wanted women to be able to achieve as a reporter. I would be interviewing a lot of them. And so that it prodded me on to try to help other women by giving something of myself and a little bit of the establishment. I was a little bit more respectable than many of the women who were out in the streets. I had worked in the establishment in politics, and I was happy to share that identity and laughter, wit, which I'm blessed with having a gift of, I hope. And we needed to laugh at ourselves, Terry. We took ourselves too seriously at first because we were so intent, and there was not as much laughter. And laughter is a very winning trait. We win friends with it.
When you started getting involved in the ERA and when you became a co-founder of the National Women's Political Caucus, did you look back on the men who you work with during your political career and start to react differently toward them? And I'm thinking maybe of John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Did you review their actions in a different light after you became a feminist activist?
Any consciousness raising makes you review and see things that you didn't see before. I didn't do it in anger. I thought both of them were fabulous, and both of them had many pluses on their side as far as women are concerned. But they still were part of that kind of old mold where you were more comfortable in a circle of men. Now, Johnson, not so much as Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy grew up in a background where it really was kind of Boston male-oriented. Johnson was out of the Southwest, where a lot of the pioneers were male and female, and they were strong types down there. And he was much more at home with women, I think, and willing to take on their cause, although we were just at the very beginning of this. And he didn't take it on as much as Betty Ford or as much as Jimmy and Rosalind Carter. Of course, now we have a stalemate because nobody is shouting about ERA from the White House. They're against it.
You started your career as a journalist.
Yes.
And then you moved into politics. This is a career change that I think a lot of journalists go through. There's a bit of a revolving door between politics and journalism. Did you feel like you were turning your back on your profession when you went into politics?
No, I didn't, because I was answering the questions instead of asking them. But in a way, I wondered if I could go back and recapture, you know, the talent of writing words into a story and not just putting them in a press release or writing a speech. And that didn't turn out to be a major problem. One of the things I did worry about was my husband and I had a news bureau in Washington and kind of a round-the-clock marriage and marvelous conversation about what was going on. And so I did miss that some, but he encouraged me very much to take on this new challenge of working for Lyndon Johnson. And so I did it.
My guest is Liz Carpenter, who was an assistant to Lyndon Johnson when he was a vice president and then became press secretary to Lady Bird Johnson when she was first lady. She's an activist in the women's rights movement and the author of a new memoir titled Getting Better All the Time. You wrote LBJ's speech after the Kennedy assassination.
Yes.
That must have been a very difficult thing to write. I mean, who would know what to say after a national tragedy of that magnitude?
You know, it came, and I cannot say it came from in me. It came from above, genes, something. But somehow at the time of a terrible day, and you're called upon to be a survivor. And my role had been being a writer, writing remarks for LBJ. And so as we were moving out of Dallas to Air Force One, somehow my hand went into my purse, pulled out a pencil and a pad, knowing as a reporter that I had been, that I would, that he would be faced with a battery of reporters when we stepped off the plane in Washington, and he'd need some words. And so the words just began to come, and I don't think I rewrote them. I think that they just came, and without any real conscious effort, and I can't help but feel they were God-given. And this was true also, I think, to other people. All of us were moving around in a sort of a trauma. We still trying to reject what had happened. And I remember the two wire service reporters just automatically moved to telephones at Parkland Hospital and grabbed the phones. But that's their profession telling them more than any conscious effort. The White House photographer knew he had to have the picture of the swearing in, and he set about doing that. So you kind of went about your work in a trance.
You started that message for Johnson with a very simple and very moving line. You wrote, "This is a sad time for all people."
Yes.
What did you open with that?
I first started thinking this is a sad time for all Americans, but Kennedy was beloved around the world, and so it seemed to be too limiting.
So you came up with, "This is a sad time
for all Americans and for all people," and then I ask your help and God's at the end.
You became Lady Bird's press secretary, and you say that you saw the job as helping her help him, of helping the first lady help the president.
That encompasses everything, doesn't it?
Well, but I wonder, what can you really do as the press secretary for the first lady? What's your best way of helping the president?
Well, by making her his translator, and he deserved one, and a president is terribly busy doing their things, and Lady Bird could go out and walk through the Head Start projects in Newark, New Jersey, or the Job Corps in Kentucky, and she had been a reporter herself briefly, but she had been a trained journalist with a Bachelor of Journalism degree from the University of Texas. So she really knew what the five W's and the H are. She knew the difference between an AM and a PM. And if she could go and help kind of be the catalyst that brought out the story of what the kids in Head Start were like before and after the program, it certainly was helpful in selling the program to Congress and to the people.
How did the duties divide between the presidential press secretary and the first lady press secretary?
Well, I briefly said I took care of women's dogs and old brocades. Previous press secretaries had sometimes been annoyed that they had to answer questions about the animals at the White House, the feature story side of the White House. But it was the family side of the White House, anything that encompassed the children, the daughters, the dogs, the questions about, the restoration of a room or the purchase of a new piece of furniture, was my department. They stuck to, on the president's side of the White House, the issues.
What were some of the greatest crises that you had to cope with as press secretary to the First Lady?
Well, two that kind of dropped in on me were the weddings of the two daughters. And this is because I'm not by nature a press spokesman about weddings, but I was thrust into that. And there were about 85 to 100 women reporters who were eager to know every tedious detail about the plans for the weddings. And it was a joyous kind of relief, I think, from the steady barrage of stories about Vietnam that were certainly full of our front pages. And all the world does love a lover, so romance was ripe in the White House, and that was some of it. That you would get cornered on small things like, did Lucy's wedding gown have a union label in it? And this would be drop out of the sky. You didn't even know, and you have to find out, did it? And if it didn't, it better.
I bet a sense of humor would help disarm strange or hostile questions.
Absolutely. And so during those series of briefings every day on what was happening in the last 2 weeks of the wedding, I'd try to find a button that would say Marine Power when Linda was marrying a Marine, or some other kind of thing that was typical of the day, or to give them a taste of the sampling of the wedding cake we were going to have. Laughter helps a lot on anything when you're in a tense situation, and it served presidents very well, you know.
Well, you actually were the head of a round table to come up with jokes for
humor lines.
LBJ.
Yes. Well, I like to write humor, Terry. And so he asked me, he'd say, Liz, sex up this speech. And by sex up, he didn't mean it in the basic content of the words. He meant make the first of it, the introduction of it, humorous, so people will relate and you'll get going into the speech. And so I got together some of the best writers around the White House. Peter Benchley, who later went on to write Jaws, Jack McNulty, who later went on to be vice president of General Motors, Harry Middleton, who's head of the LBJ Library, and an array of them. And we'd gather together once a week, I think it was a Thursday afternoon, and sit in my office and think, what is topical that you could write humor about today? And it just was a way to improve LBJ's personal mood, I think, and second, to win listeners who would. Johnson was not a great speechmaker, I don't think. I think the words were fabulous, and there were times he was magnificent, but most of the time he really had too much of a steady voice that did not have enough variety in it. And so when he could get the playback from his audience of a laugh or something, suddenly he'd become more of a ham, and that helped him.
Can you remember any of the openers that you came up with that you were proudest of?
Well, let me see. Oh, you're pressing me. I know that at the when he did his last swan song before the National Press Club, he said, you know, everybody criticized him for showing his scar after he had the gallbladder operation. That was very Johnsonian, not that he wanted to show his scar, but when a reporter said that he wanted to see it, he just shared it. Well, the cameras clicked, of sorts. Course, and he was widely criticized, and it made him furious. Well, on that last day in office, he said, you know, they asked me, what have you got to show for your presidency, Mr. President? And so I showed my scar. That's what I had. And he took some of the things that had been flaws in his administration and criticized and, you know, leveled with the press and made light of them. Gerald Ford had an arm-around-the-shoulder humor that would lighten the load very much after Watergate, I think.
My guest is Liz Carpenter. She's a women's rights activist and a former press secretary to First Lady Lady Bird Johnson. She's written a memoir titled Getting Better All the Time. We'll talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Liz Carpenter is my guest. She's written a new memoir. It's titled Getting Better All the Time. When you were first secretary to Lady Bird Johnson, I'm sure that there were plenty of times when she was out on one of her beautification campaigns when she was met by anti-war demonstrators and when that became a part of the story that the press covered. Actually, I'm sure you must have run into that a lot, where anti-war demonstrations were receiving more coverage than the message that you and she wanted to get out. What was your stand on the war then?
Well, after 1966, when things began to get worse in Vietnam and you were getting more demonstrators, well, that's when the signs began to go up. And she would be out trying to tell not just about beautification, but about many other things like the war on poverty, and suddenly these signs would appear, and the newswomen would just and the picture would be the sign. All you did was try to plead with them. You could not manage their news, but you would try to hope that somehow the story of the Job Corps camp, of the boy that had been improved by it, would get in. But often it was taken away from you, and that made it very difficult and discouraging. But she still kept on keeping on.
Was it ever hard for you in that administration to be in a position of defending the war?
Well, I never was in that area of competency, so to speak, and people didn't expect me to do that. I certainly heard plenty of blasts at Johnson because of it, but I was not handling foreign policy, and so I can't really say that anyone tried to pin me down. It did make my job more difficult simply because it was, when your boss is being criticized, it's not easy.
As you pointed out, the press secretary, the first lady, frequently covers the family issues. And first ladies' issues are frequently involved in things like beautification campaigns. Or
causes. They choose.
Yeah. Do you think that, as a feminist now, do you think that the first lady could take a more activist position than first ladies have traditionally taken? Do you think maybe the job should change or is changing?
Well, she is not elected by anybody but one person. Her husband. And so I think that the public will resent too much visible interference. But on the other hand, I give our first ladies the right of all the options. If they want to stay on the second floor and do needlepoint, that is their right, and there's no requirement, no job requirement. I don't think they'll enjoy it. I don't think that they will take advantage of a podium, a sort of podium they have from the White House. But they ought to choose something that comes naturally. And with Lady Bird, the love of the landscape and what we can do about it was very much true to her heart and her desires. So it sold itself. She's still at it at almost 75 years old with the National Wildflower Research Center. But I think it seems alien when you pick something that doesn't come naturally just to have a cause per se.
You found out that Johnson was resigning, like most of us did, by watching television.
Yeah,
you saw his speech. And later learned that his speech had two endings, one in which he resigned and one in which he didn't.
That's the one I'd read earlier that afternoon.
The one in which he didn't resign. Well, did you feel angry that you had to find out about this from television?
Not at all. I went right down to the White House. A Lady Bird called me and said they'd wanted to tell me. And they made a point of calling staff real quickly after the broadcast so you wouldn't have this. But I was sorry that he decided not to. Because I think that, we went into the Nixon period, and so, and ultimately Watergate. But it would have been tough for him to get reelected, because as he realized, he was not the person to rally people together when everyone was so divided on Vietnam.
You went into politics as a former journalist.
Yes.
Was your opinion of journalism changed by being on the other end? Because as a political press secretary, it was your job to try to get out certain information and to manage the news. You had been on the receiving end of that beforehand. And it seems to me there's this implicit distrust that a lot of journalists have toward press secretaries and that many press secretaries have towards journalists.
So, I think I'm less hard-nosed about political reporting than I was before. I realize more of the pressures on a political figure than I did before. I guess that if I went back being a journalist, I would see the public figure with a little more perception. I know we do batter our candidates pretty much, and some of them deserve it, but we do batter our candidates, and that's why a dreadful thing is happening in the country, and that we make it so tough to run for office and so costly that we're losing out on some of the cream of the crop.
Do you distrust journalists or politicians more than you did before?
Oh, that comes a little with age, but I also know that there are voices out there that are very strong and very right. I know I like, my natural inclination is to like people in public life, and both journalists and reporters are, because I'm fascinated with politics. And so the people who are participating on either side of the pad and pencil are people that I like to talk to.
Liz Carpenter is my guest, and she's written a memoir titled Getting Better All the Time. As we mentioned before, you started this memoir when you were 65, and it was around 11 years after your husband mm-hmm. died. And somewhere in the book you write, "At my age, the circle of men to marry is practically zero level, yet I am more interesting and have more time. But who wants to nurse an aging man? It's too late for marriage." I was surprised to hear you say that.
Well, maybe I shouldn't have said it, but I think that at this time of life, you think, I don't know, my health may be frail. I am, generally you have some kind of ailment, something in what I call the parts department. You're losing a knee or an eye or a bosom, and yet I might want to retract that statement, because some marvelous romance has come into my life.
Really?
And it came in at the time I had some a mastectomy this year. And so I'm not interested in marriage. I am interested in romance, and it was very therapeutic. And an old friend came back into my life that I'd known 47 years ago at the University of Texas. We're the same age.
Why romance but not marriage? Is it
Well, I think that I'm not a good bet for anybody, since I have cancer in my background, and I think that well, now, I don't know. That's kind of a tough question. But I think at this point also, Terry, I don't want to change my books. I've just gotten all the bookkeeping straight in the process of widowhood. I have a neighbor who doesn't want to mess up her tennis games. And so marriage is not so much the end of the road here. And I think that I would much rather just enjoy somebody's company occasionally than to have the breathing room of the independence that I've come to know and enjoy some of.
You think the legal and financial arrangements in a marriage later in life
Yes.
are much more complicated than they are earlier
They
on?
They are. I know that it takes quite a contract to get it all straightened out. But I think that I have a total understanding about that with the person I know and like. And we just like each other's company, and life has been fuller and happier for us since we've known each other.
And at this point in your life, it wouldn't bother you to have intimate relations and not be officially married?
Well, that's a question that I'd rather not answer.
Oh, fine.
I don't think it would bother me, but it's romance I'm looking for.
Okay, well, I really wish you the best.
And thank you so much.
Very much for joining us. You wanted to read part of a poem. Let me ask you to read that before we have to end.
There is a poem called Come the Dawn, written by a woman from New York, and it really does discuss what most people have gone through in learning to live alone. So you plant your own garden and decorate your own soul instead of waiting for someone to bring you flowers. And you learn that you really can endure, that you really are strong, and you really do have worth. And you learn and learn. With every goodbye, you learn. And, of course, that's the constructive side of grief. If you can learn and learn and then blossom again, that's the answer.
With that, Liz Carpenter, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Terry.
For being here. My guest has been Liz Carpenter. She's an active women's rights activist, a co-founder of the National Women's Political Caucus, former press secretary to Lady Bird Johnson. She's written a memoir titled Getting Better All the Time, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with William Atwood, a former reporter, publisher, and U.S. ambassador. Atwood has written a memoir of his experiences during the Cold War, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, brothers Daniel and Luis Valdez talk about bringing the life of rock star Ritchie Valens to the screen in their new film, La Bamba. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews pianist Shura Tchaikovsky's recent recording of works by Liszt and Stravinsky. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg looks at the controversy over making English the official American language. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording featuring pianist Shura Tchaikovsky playing compositions by Liszt and Stravinsky.
One of the many delights of a new CD on Nimbus, a recital by 75-year-old pianist Shura Tchaikovsky, isn't on the recording. It's an interview reprinted from the London Times. "Let me tell you about my character," he tells the interviewer. "It's so much more interesting to talk about than music. I'm a man of extremes and obsessions. When I say I'll practice 4 hours, it'll never be 3 hours, 59 minutes. I'm literal. My wife used to say she thought she was marrying an artist, not a metronome. It's one of the reasons we divorced. He claims he goes to concerts only to hear bad artists, to remind me how to play," he says. Tchaikovsky, a student of the great Josef Hoffmann, was born in Russia but was brought to America as an infant. He made his debut at 11 and shortly thereafter played at the White House for President Harding. He began his recording career nearly half a century ago and developed quite a reputation for playing Russian music and the bravura pieces of Liszt, also for not playing anything the same way twice. I quote again, "Sometimes I say to myself, now shall I surprise them today and play this passage piano, or shall I shock them with a forte? I think I'll be naughty and shock them." This disc doesn't sound like the work of a septuagenarian. Maybe these performances, recorded in 1985 in England where he now lives, aren't quite as wild as his earlier ones are reported to have been, but they are refreshingly spontaneous and full of rhythmical surprises. It's the security of his understanding of both style and content that keeps him from going over the edge. Tchaikovsky convinces you that this is just how the music is supposed to go. I have to confess that my favorite work on this disc is Liszt's Second Hungarian Rhapsody. It's a piece I've had an inordinate fondness for ever since I first heard the men of Texaco who work from Maine to Mexico sing it every Tuesday night on the Milton Berle Show. Several years ago at Harvard, Charles Rosen, in one of his Norton lectures on Romanticism, vindicated my questionable taste by arguing that Liszt's greatest contribution to piano literature may lie in his popular rather than his serious compositions. It's in them you can find his most adventurous explorations of sonority. Tchaikovsky's performance of the Liszt B minor sonata on this disc is extraordinary in the way certain unexpected understatements serve to heighten the intensity of Liszt's passionate outbursts. And his playing of Stravinsky's 3 movements from Petrushka is not only practically orchestral in its virtuosity, but deeply touching in its characterization of Stravinsky's pathetic puppet protagonist. but it's the truly Hungarian Rhapsody, with its heroic yet playful edge-of-the-diving-board suspensions, that I keep coming back to most. Shura Cherkassky playing Liszt on a new Nimbus CD. There are also three previous Cherkassky discs on Nimbus, including a Chopin record and a recital disc that has Abram Chasins' 1929 Rush Hour in Hong Kong. Despite Cherkassky's disclaimer, his music may in fact be even more interesting than his character.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He's a poet and teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Lloyd reviewed a new CD by Shura Cherkassky on Nimbus. Cherkassky will be performing next Monday, July 20th, at the Newport Music Festival in Rhode Island. You're listening to Fresh Air. In 1958, a Mexican-American teenager named Richie Valens had three songs on top of the rock and roll charts: Come On, Let's Go, Donna, and La Bamba. La Bamba was a popular Latin folk song that Valens adapted to a rock and roll beat. Richie Valens grew up in various California migrant labor camps and poor neighborhoods near Los Angeles. His music brought him and his family out of poverty, but his career was short-lived. After only 8 months in the spotlight, Valens died in a plane crash along with Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper. Valens was the first Chicano rock and roll star. After his death, he remained a hero to many young Chicanos. The life of Richie Valens is the subject of a new film called La Bamba. It stars newcomer Lou Diamond Phillips and was written and directed by playwright Luis Valdez. Valdez is the founder of El Teatro Campesino and the creator of the play Zoot Suit about Chicano teenagers in the 1940s. Zoot Suit starred Luis Valdez's younger brother, Daniel. Daniel is the associate producer of La Bamba and first proposed doing this film 14 years ago. I asked Luis, then Daniel, about what the song La Bamba meant to them.
La Bamba, especially, signaled a turn in rock and roll, and in a way a turn in my life. I took it as a sign of hope and inspiration.
Daniel, you're 9 years younger than your brother. What was your life like when Richie Valens' hits were on the radio, and what kind of memories do you have of that period?
Well, I was 10 years old when Richie died, and it was really a time for me when I kind of disappeared into the radio, so to speak, and got lost in the teenage world of rock and roll. And there's a term that they used to refer to Richie Valens, the late great Richie Valens. You know, I always heard that on the radio. Here's another hit from the late great Richie Valens. Outside of the fact that he epitomized what the whole teenage image of that rock and roll era was about, you know, there was a myth to Richie that stayed there and remains there.
As part of your research for the movie, you tracked down Richie Valens' family. How did you find them? Was it hard to do?
Yeah, it was very difficult. I mean, it's a little like chasing a shadow, you know. And it wasn't until actually about 1982, late 82, that I ran into a series of articles that were printed in that year that basically covered the crash and stuff like that. And it was from that that I was able to get somewhat of a family sketch. I found out his name was Valenzuela. But no mentioning about the family, where they went, what happened to them. I went back to Los Angeles, at least with a name, to try and track back. I knew that he had gone to Pacoima Junior High because of the stuff in the articles. But what about the people? What happened to the people? And it was in October, Halloween night of 1983, that I got a phone call from a friend of mine who was working the concession stand at our theater in San Juan, who said, "You got to come over here because Richie Valens' brother's standing here." And I said, "Yeah, sure, right?" So I went, and I met Mario, who was Richie Valens' younger brother. And it was from that that I found out that the family lived 16 miles away from where I lived.
So they were right under your nose
exactly,
the whole time.
Exactly. It was amazing.
What was Richie Valens' family's reaction to your desire to do a movie about Richie Valens?
Well, it was nothing new. They were very skeptical. At the time, you know, when I approached them, we didn't talk about anything specific in terms of a movie or anything. I just basically told them that I felt it was important to document any kind of background on Richie that we could get, because he was important to kids, and he was certainly important to Chicanos. You know? But little by little, I mean, the wall of resistance had to be dealt with. And it took about a year and a half just really to feel confident with one another.
Bob, who is the brother that really helped you find out what you needed to know to make the movie, is portrayed in the movie as a pretty nasty, selfish, violent kind of guy. He's the opposite of Richie Valens. Richie Valens is very, very, very nice, very respectful, very, very decent. And his brother is a petty thief, kind of an alcoholic who does drugs, abuses women. What did he think of his portrayal in the movie?
Well, he led us to that portrayal in the film. It's important to say, I think, that in spite of the fact that we had all of these photographs and clippings that told the surface of Richie Valens' career and the details of his death, there was very little that was personal. What remained was an icon. What remained was a saint. That left Bob. Bob was the key. And Bob opened up. I told him, look, our problem is that we need to understand Richie as a human being. He has to be real. So he began to talk, and he gave us not only an impression of Richie, but certainly an impression of them together as brothers, and an impression of his own role. He was not sparing in terms of treatment of himself. I think he was harsh, almost too harsh, really, about himself. in a way, he was getting it all out. We took a long walk through Pacoima and many of the places where they'd played, and some of the which are in the movie, these scenes are in the movie. His last run, you know, toward his mother's house when he hears of Richie's death on the radio. All of that ended with Bob with tears streaming down his face and saying he hadn't cried in 30 years, but that he was glad they'd finally gotten these things out and that he told me.
Let's talk about the casting of Richie Valens. Daniel, you were initially supposed to play Richie Valens, but you were too old by the time the movie was actually made. The way the movie was actually made, the actor who plays Richie Valens doesn't do the singing. It's the group Los Lobos,
right,
who performs all of the music, so it's lip-synced by the actor. Was that your intention from the start, to have the actor just do lip-syncing, or did you try to find someone who could sing as well as act?
We tried. We arrived after a long process of auditioning. We saw over 300 young men in Los Angeles alone, another couple of hundred in Chicago, New York. Finally crossed the T nationally, went over to Texas. What we were looking for was an actor, singer, musician, which is an impossible combination, actually. I mean, we would have rediscovered a Richie Valens if we'd found this kid. So we set up a chart, sort of a grid pattern, and certain priorities on one side, certain priorities up the other side, and ended up, by process of elimination, deciding on an actor. We figured the most important thing is that this person had to be able to convey the humanity of Richie Valens. He had to have a goodness of spirit and yet a certain kind of ferocity.
And innocence.
Yes, and innocence. Consequently, we read whatever actors auditioned for Richie, we read them as Bob as well, you see, and vice versa, because they had to be brothers. And so they had to have this interlocking relationship. And I think Lou has done a fantastic job of not only communicating the spirit of Richie Valens, the goodness of heart, but also his ferocity on the stage.
In part of the movie, Richie Valens has really made the American dream. He has a suburban home. He has a new car. He has an attractive white blonde girlfriend and hit records. And you don't begrudge him that. You don't condemn him for his assimilation or his prosperity. And I had a feeling that a few years ago, maybe you might have.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a few years ago when it was a different time. You're talking about the 1960s in some ways. You know, it was a period of ethnic self-definition, you know, part of self-determination. Richie was a product of the 50s, before the 60s, but he assumed that the dream was valid for him, too. I mean, he didn't put any obstacles before himself and say, oh, I can't have a blonde, blue-eyed girlfriend, or I can't be a rock and roll singer. He didn't put all those obstacles in front of himself. He went for it, and he achieved it. And I think that's a tribute to him. He opened the door for a lot of Hispanics who may not feel that they can participate fully. Daniel and I, through our work in Hollywood, are trying to open many doors, you know. And, I mean, well, you look at us. I mean, we look Indian, you know. And but we're Anglo-Hispanics. We speak English. You know, we've eaten hamburgers all our lives and hot dogs and, you know, played baseball. I mean, we're Americans. Come on, give us a break. I mean, that's what the story is.
But I think it's taken 30 years to look back and look at Richie Valens and see what his contributions really were.
I want to thank you both for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Daniel and Luis Valdez talking about their film La Bamba, which opens on July 24th. Tomorrow I'll talk more with Luis Valdez about his own migration from the California fields to Broadway and Hollywood. Here's the group Los Lobos with their version of La Bamba. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you covering today?
Well, in our ongoing coverage of the Iran-Contra hearings, tonight we'll have a report on the testimony of Vice Admiral John Poindexter, who testified today, and the White House reaction to that testimony. Also, conversations with four military experts who offer us their reactions to the fact that military men like Poindexter have played such a key role in the Iran-Contra scandal.
I understand you're also celebrating an anniversary.
Yes, Terry, we are. Just whistle while you wear. The movie Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs celebrates its 50th birthday this year. I talked to animator Mark Davis about the making of the film.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In countries where residents speak different languages, governments have dealt with the issue in various ways. In the United States, there's a movement to legislate English as the official language. Commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has these thoughts.
You may have heard that out here in California, we have proclaimed English our official state language. 73% of the voters approved an English-only amendment to the state constitution last fall. In the wake of that landslide, politicians in at least 30 other states have introduced official language measures of one sort or another. In some places, these bills have only a symbolic importance. But they could have serious consequences in states like California, Texas, and Arizona, where there are large immigrant populations, by making it impossible for the states to deliver a wide range of essential services in other languages. For example, an immigrant who arrives with imperfect English would find it impossible to obtain information about school enrollment or workman's compensation, or even to apply for a driver's license. In other words, the bills would make it harder for immigrants to enter the economic and social mainstream. And the effects would be even more serious if we were ever to ratify the proposed official language amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The proponents of these measures say they're necessary to give people an incentive to learn English, to send a message to immigrants that you need English to get on in America. They raise the specters of communities like Canada and Belgium, where language differences have led to political disunity. At first blush, this doesn't sound like such bad logic. In fact, I've met a lot of people who were surprised to find that the movement wouldn't be attractive to someone like me, a linguist with an almost proprietary interest in the English language. But when you think about it, the logic of these arguments doesn't really hold up. For one thing, history shows that you can't get people to adopt a new language by force of law alone. The Soviets have learned this the hard way in their attempts to impose Russian on their language minorities in areas like Georgia and the Ukraine. These Russification policies, as they're called, have met with stiff resistance and even mass demonstrations. And this was back in the days before Glasnost. What's more, there's no need to wave a stick when you have so alluring a carrot as English. Without any state interference, the English language has gone from being the language of a small island nation off the coast of Europe to the most successful world language in history. We don't have to send a message to immigrants before they realize that you have to know English if you want to get on in America. This is not exactly a state secret, after all. A 1985 RAND Corporation survey showed that 95% of Hispanics born in America are proficient in English. Proposing that the English language needs a special advantage is sort of like proposing that Magic Johnson would benefit from a pair of elevator shoes. But the problem isn't just that these official language measures are unnecessary. What's more troubling, they suggest a misunderstanding of what America's all about. In effect, what the English-only people are saying is that common democratic values aren't a sufficient basis for national unity, that you can't really understand American values unless you share the same culture and language as everybody else. Now, this is clearly not what the framers of the Constitution had in mind. In fact, they explicitly rejected making English the official language of the new United States at a time when the country actually had a larger proportion of non-English speakers than it does now. I must say that I'm heartened by a recent New York Times CBS News poll that shows that support for these official language measures has been dropping sharply. A year ago, 60% of the people surveyed favored this sort of legislation, and only 36% were opposed. Now, opinion is split at 47% each way. I think what this shows is that a lot of people have had a chance to reflect on what these bills are really about, and that they've realized that the framers of the Constitution were right to leave government out of the language business.
Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a preview of tomorrow's program. On our next show, part two of our discussion with Luis Valdez, the writer and director of La Bamba, the new film on the life of Ritchie Valens. We'll talk about Valdez's life from his childhood as a migrant farm worker to his current theater and film work. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review a new album by the British group Wire, and film critic Stephen Schiff will review RoboCop, the futuristic cop thriller starring Peter Weller and Nancy Allen. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's program was produced by Fred Landerl, with producers Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.